Happy Friday. It is 4 o'clock, and that means it is time for lots of good fun. Here we go.
Express yourself. Express yourself. You don't never need help from nobody else. All you got to do now, express yourself. Whatever you do, do it good. Whatever you do, 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 Lord, Lord. You look like when you're doing what you're doing, it's what you're doing when you're doing what you look like you're doing. Express yourself.
Oh, yeah, express yourself. Welcome to Express Yourself, where arts, culture, and conversation intersect. I'm Amy Kimberly, and we have a great show lined up for you. Today, we head up Valley to explore Jazz Aspen and the CMC Clay Show, which opened last night. And we take a little trip to New Orleans to talk with Tuba Skinny. Then we check in with Dance Initiative, Aneta Yushlaume, which honestly, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. And I've watched every DJ kind of butcher that. So it should be interesting. And we will find out the correct way to pronounce that soon. But Netta is a New York Israeli-based dance company, and they are going to be residing in Carbondale next week. So you really want to stay tuned. Want to remind everyone that True Nature has an outdoor concert this evening starting at 6, and KDNK will be broadcasting it live. Also, Snowmass is bringing free concerts every Thursday, and Carbondale Summer Music kicked off last week. I mean, things feel almost normal. Also, Juneteenth is official, and it happens tomorrow. I just want to say a huge shout-out of love and honor for all the amazing contributions from our Black communities in the United States, and hope that we all work as hard as we can to erase this blight called racism from our country. It is completely unacceptable. All right, let's get right into this. I am going to give a little call to Jim Horowitz. He's the creator and producer of Jazz Aspen Snowmass, happening next week. And while we wait, and in honor of Juneteenth, let's play a little Dumpster Funk, United Nations Stomp. We'll be right back. That's right. That's just a little dumpster funk for you. They're playing next week at Jazz Aspen Snowmass. And I have Jim Horowitz on the line. Are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm right here.
All right. Wow, I love when technology works. All right. So, gosh, you know, I really appreciate you taking some time with us. How does it feel to finally get to produce a real festival again?
It's kind of surreal. You know, we've been working and planning for so long, and then the plans changed, and then they changed again, and now it's a little bit of a pinch me moment, but it's a good one. You know, really, the anticipation is high. The Surreal MA, the wonderful artist who's opening our season tonight and has been here before, she's a great favorite. It's like welcoming back a dear friend, and I ran into her last night. As it turns out, at the free concert in Snowmass Village, I spied her off there to the side with her band members sort of dancing and just the spirit of music that's live. It's really something else. So can't wait.
Yeah. I've had a lot of people that have attended the Snowmass concerts, and everybody's reaction is like, wow, I feel like I haven't been around so many people in such a long time.
And that's because you haven't.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you produce two big festivals a year, and the June festival's always been a different format than Labor Day.
Sure.
But with COVID and this kind of new normal, how are you approaching this June concert? It's a little different.
Well, it's completely different even from what we did 2 years ago, and that it's all the same venues, which is to say about eight venues in town, all within a 5-minute walk. However, the difference this year is that unlike 2 years ago, this was already a reinvention of the June Festival, which had been at the Benedict Tent for 10 years from 2009 through 2018. In 2019, for a variety of reasons, we decided it was time to make it more akin to the Jazz Cafe experience of great music and small settings of jazz and related forms, and made it like a club crawl where you could just, with one wristband, look at your grid of bands and what time they played, and just like you were going to New Orleans, you circled them. But you might change your mind along the way, and you might change your mind even halfway through a show. And the format a couple of years ago was basically, hey, once you have a wristband, go anywhere you want. It's first come, first serve. And what people found they were able to do was to hear a lot of music in a given night, a lot of different variety, a lot of different venues, and they could walk from place to place. And it was really very, very unusual. It was like being in the French Quarter and just going from block to block and place to place. However, this year, we had to, because of COVID, and really until a few weeks ago, and it wasn't as simple as just flipping a switch, all of the different venues had different restrictions on the number of people. And that caused us to have to organize things into actual schedules so that, you know, here's a bunch of different options. You can still hear three or four bands a night. You just have to choose your schedule. So the experience is similar, but it's a little bit different, but it still comes down to hearing a variety of great music in a given night between a number of different venues, and generally speaking, walking from one to the other and enjoying the feeling of being like in the French Quarter. If we could close your eyes and imagine. Mm-hmm. There you go.
I know. I've got an interview with Tuba Skinny coming up after this. And
excellent.
They really bring that.
Wonderful band who I discovered exactly walking in the French Quarter of New Orleans about 12 years ago.
That's right. Yeah,
exactly.
This is their second performance at Jazz Aspen.
Yes.
Well, you know, you have quite an array of performers, from Take Six to George Porter Jr. to Tuba Skinny. When you're putting together the lineup, do you really go for that diversity, or is it, well, this is who's available? You know, do you have a specific plan in mind?
Yes. No, there's definitely a plan, and the plan is based on diversity, for sure. That's not accidental. It's meant to be, to cast a kind of a wide net, of different genres of music, again, that are jazz related, but not exclusively jazz. That's why we say jazz and related forms of music. Mm-hmm. So We have blues, we have New Orleans music, we have gospel music, we have soul, we have funk. All of these things relate to the roots of the music that produced jazz, but it gives a wide variety of artists, basically, for people to choose from and experience all within a small period of time. And that, to us, is what makes a festival a festival. It's bringing all those different artists together.
Yeah.
So, and then we start with a general idea. In the case of a Take 60, you mentioned one of the ideas for this 30th year celebration was to honor and bring back some of our absolute most favorite artists who've had the biggest successes here. And Take 6, mm-hmm. we've had a relationship that almost stretches 30 years. They literally first came to Aspen in 1992 and performed at the Benedict Music Tent as a headline artist. They were just really becoming mm-hmm. famous then. So mm-hmm. we've had a long relationship with them. So part of this festival included inviting back artists that we really had a close relationship to. And then the other part is to bring some artists that we haven't ever had before.
Mm-hmm.
And Dumps the Funk is a band like that. Betty Levette, the great blues singer, is a band like that that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. Juanito Pascual, the flamenco guitarist. And so it's a combination of old and new and a lot of variety of great, great artists.
Well, it looks great, Jim. Before I let you go, you just released the fall lineup as well, which looks pretty exciting. Just as a personal choice, what are you most excited about in your lineups?
Well, that's like asking a parent to choose between their children. It's impossible to answer. I'm most excited about all of them. That it's really the whole, like a Buckminster Fuller, I'm dating myself, said, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And the eight artists who are on the main stage as a group together are a pretty impressive group, very diverse, again, including some favorite returning artists like Sheryl Crow and Gary Clark Jr. And then three debuts, headline artists and that may be the first time, I'm not 100% sure, but that we ever had a Labor Day weekend event that included three headliners Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, all making their JAS debuts. So that's exciting. But I'll say it's all of them.
Yeah, well, that's great. So one of my questions was, how long have you been there? But 30 years, I guess, and you started 30. Out as a jazz yeah. pianist yourself, right? You still playing
yeah.
that jazz?
I still do. I still have the same piano that I owned from when I decided to be a professional pianist for, you know, seriously, and then in my early 20s. And then within a few years, I was like, I need to own a real piano. And so I still own that piano. It's a beautiful Steinway Baby Grand, but it lives with me, and yeah, that's it. I still play. I don't play as much as I used to by far, but, you know, I play when I can.
Well, thanks so much for taking your time with us. People can still get tickets at jazzaspensnowmass.org. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And what I want to particularly mention is that in addition, the three-day passes are pretty much sold out, but there are a lot of individual tickets for different bands at different venues. And if you go to the website, you will see shows, almost all the bands can be heard someplace or one venue or another with just a ticket for that show that night. So I would encourage people to not think because they heard the passes were sold out, there's no option. That's not true. You could hear a lot of bands still just by, and the tickets are very, very reasonable. So I would definitely suggest going to our website and look at jazzaspensnowmass.org, and the June Festival will pop right up, and it will go to where it says tickets, and then it'll show you everything that's available.
Well, thank you so much for taking your time with us. I tell everybody out there, get on your dancing shoes because it's happening. Summer is on.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Bye. All right, you guys. Well, let's get right into tuba skinny. I keep wanting to say skinny tuba, but actually it is skinny tuba. They are fabulous folks. You don't want to miss them. I am here with Robin Rapuzzi of Tuba Skinny, and they are playing Jazz Aspen next week. You're a loose collection of street musicians, as you describe yourselves. Dedicated to bringing the traditional New Orleans sound to audiences. I guess I have two questions in that statement. How loose are you? And what really is the traditional New Orleans sound to you?
I guess to me, the traditional New Orleans sound is jazz that's played with an emphasis in ensemble work. So that's when you have different melodies going on at once, playing over on top of each other and beneath each other, and they harmonize, and it's improvised. Improvisation is really important to all New Orleans music, and still to this day.
It's true, and that probably also goes back to the street musician, which I find is interesting because some people would just describe themselves as musicians, but there is something about the ethos of a street musician. Can you kind of explain that?
The world over, there are all sorts of different kinds of street musicians, you know, that have a different, you know, they're playing different genres of music, and they might not think of ensemble the same way. But I think the reason we describe ourselves as street musicians is because we play on the street. It's where we first met each other. And with street performing, you always kind of have to keep things loose because you don't really know if you're going to have the same musicians in the same band every day.
Mm-hmm.
And there aren't really too many rules involved because it's all up to you to organize your time on the street and when and where you're performing.
That's right. And you have to improvise a lot. And you never know
right.
what's coming down the pike.
You'd never know, especially in the French Quarter.
So did you grow up in New Orleans?
No, none of us are from New Orleans originally. We're from all over the country.
But you were attracted to New Orleans. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of reasons someone would be attracted to being there. But it feels like that kind of passion for ensemble, authenticity, you know, that street vibe of being out there as a musician, is that what brought you there, or did you discover that when you were there?
Well, a good way to put it simply, before any of the musicians came to New Orleans, either before or after Katrina when the band started, a lot of us were traveling around the country playing our own street music by ourselves or with other groups in other places. So New Orleans has a history of being like a great place to play music on the street. And I think that, and it's also a very authentic place compared to the rest of the U.S., stands out on its own always. And I think that probably inspired a lot of us to come down here. But we really just kind of met up through music in other places, or, you know, we had heard from like mutual friends that New Orleans is a great place to play on the street and do well. And so we came down here and tried it out. I personally came down here looking for inspiration for stories. At the time, I was writing short stories, and my buddy told me New Orleans was very inspiring.
Are you still writing?
No, not as frequently as I used to, but I do still write, yeah. Not in the same way. I've really, you know, taken on playing music for my livelihood.
That's wonderful. And really, Tuba Skinny, you've been all over the place. Obviously, we've had this crazy last year, of which you all managed to record an album. How did that work?
Well, basically, this great folk singer, Maria Muldaur, started visiting New Orleans. And, well, the latest album, it was produced through her record company and with her vision. She's a fan of the band, and she came down maybe like 2-3 years ago and started listening to us play on Royal Street and also at some of the French Quarter clubs. And then she started sitting in, and, you know, a handful of us knew who she was, and we felt so fortunate to be able to get to know her and play with her musically. Yeah, I guess eventually Maria decided that she wanted to make an album with us, playing blues music, blues and jazz music of women from the 20th century, all the old stuff that a lot of people surprisingly skip over. And so I think it was an album to, put a light on them.
Right, and she did the singing.
Yeah, Maria is the vocalist.
Wow, that's fantastic. And then you guys also did a quarantine album.
That was, we were going to, like normal, every springtime we produce a new album because we just have such a back catalog of songs to do. But because of quarantining and wanting to play it safe, we decided to use some leftover recordings from earlier sessions, why we call it the B-side. And we threw those together, got the mastered and mixed, and yeah, just kind of made some decisions through, you know, text messages, which recordings we like better. So yeah, at the time we still weren't meeting in person for shows or practices, obviously.
And how about during the summer last, well, I mean, I don't know about summer New Orleans, but were there times in this last year where you guys would go out on the street and play together?
Yeah, we started playing on the street again in the fall because Frenchman Street venue DBA, although they were closed inside, they still wanted to have people come to listen to music and also buy drinks from their go bar.
Mm-hmm.
And we were a little uncomfortable with playing at all again, because when you perform, you bring a crowd, which obviously mm-hmm. has been very unsafe to do in the last year. So in a sense, we were playing on the street, but it was a really cushy spot because we didn't even have to get it. DBA just set it up for us.
As a musician, this last year was hard for a lot of people. There was a lot of virtual concerts, etc. What did you guys do to survive?
To survive, we started putting videos of our music online. We would do live streams
mm-hmm.
through YouTube or Facebook mostly. It was easier that way. And we had the help of our friend, another musician, Russell Welch,
mm-hmm.
who plays in a little bighorn jazz band, another local band. He is a tech whiz. No one in Tuba Skinny understands technology very well,
mm-hmm.
You know, especially computers and recording. And yeah, we just started putting together live streams in our backyards or maybe in venues we used to play at. They would open the doors for us to play and record. And yeah, it caught on, and our fans, very good care of us. And we wouldn't still be here in the same way if our fans hadn't donated and tipped for those live stream performances. Like, we can't thank them enough.
Wow. That's, yeah. I mean, I think we learned so much in this last year, things that we never thought would have worked or happened, and they did. And I think a lot of that fandom really shone through and shone really brightly.
100%.
Yeah. So now you're out touring again. When mm-hmm. when did you start? Or is this trip to Jazz Aspen one of the first? Or how's that going?
Well, yeah, this trip to Jazz Aspen will be our first trip out of town, you know, like a tour since, you know, two summers ago. So it means a lot to us to stretch our wings again. It'll be interesting to be out and about as the band in a different place. Then again, we have played the Jazz Aspen Festival before. I think mm-hmm. it might have been our first American festival like 10 years ago that we ever played. So it will be kind of cool to see if we remember anything about it.
Yeah. Well, they'll see. It's changed quite a bit there at Jazz Aspen. Tuba Skinny, they're playing next weekend, and you can hear their music at tubaskinny.com. It's fabulous, you guys. It is the quintessential music. In fact, I think I'll play a little bit. They just recorded this album with Maria Maldar, and we'll be right back with you. We got Megan Jansen here from Dance Initiative, so don't go away.
Patience and fortitude, patience and fortitude, patience and fortitude, and things will come your way. When folks are mean and rude, stay cool, don't cop it to. Just keep that mellow mood, and things will come your way. Well, I couldn't wait for it.
Ooh, yeah, I really like the music of Tuba Skinny. It's just so much fun. All right, I'm here with Megan Jansen. Hello.
Hi.
All right, Megan is the executive director of Dance Initiative. She's been doing a killer job. Y'all may not know her yet, but you are going to see the fruits of her labor, especially this summer.
Thanks, Amy.
Oh, you bet. I mean, you came on board during COVID. It's kind of crazy. You had a lot of things planned, and then, of course, like everybody, all those plans went south. So what do you got? What do we got happening?
Well, we've kind of a packed summer, but what's coming up most immediately is our first residency that we've had since 2019. And we are bringing award-winning choreographer. Her name is Nete, and I am not going to do a great job at pronouncing her last name, so I will let her do that. And she is bringing two dancers with her. All are coming from New York. They arrive on Sunday. You can see them live at the launch pad. They'll be rehearsing all week long, essentially 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. in the main studio, working on a new piece they're calling Movement. And they have been working on this a little bit throughout the pandemic, and they're bringing it here to Carbondale to really dive in. And they'll be engaging with our community all week long and then performing this piece on Saturday, the 26th. We'll be outside at the Thompson House in Carbondale with the beautiful backdrop of Mount Sopris.
And no one else has seen this yet. This is a work in progress. That's the purpose of these residencies, right?
Exactly. So it's something that they've dabbled with a little bit, maybe worked over Zoom because of the pandemic, and are, going to all be in the same studio together for the first time in a while and dive into creating some new content for us.
And let's talk. There's a talk at Ashikawa.
Right. Wednesday night, they are showing a film that actually was a presentation that they did during COVID outside in New York City. And then they've edited that film. It's called Distant Dance Demonstration. And so we're going to show that at Ashikawa and then do a little artist talk, kind of Q&A, open for discussion for anyone that wants to come. They'll all be there to chime in and just talk with the folks of the Roaring Fork Valley. And then afterwards, we're going to have a little cocktail hour. There's some live music actually happening there that night. I just went over to Ashikawa, and they're so excited, and they've got a little special rosé that they're popping, and we'll have just some special things for everybody that shows up. It's free, so just come on down. Thursday night, the following night, we're going to do an all-levels community workshop at the launch pad. It's 2 hours. It's 6:15 to 8:15 p.m. if you want to get your body moving. One of the things that's really great about Nete is she's just really interested in bodies moving. She's not elite. She's very approachable. She's very welcoming. And so if you're someone that's been interested in moving your body lately and perhaps don't consider yourself a dancer, please come. It will be really fun and really open to everyone. And then Saturday night is the performance. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty exciting. And people can get tickets at danceinitiative.org. I already got mine.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's such a beautiful place to see art, music, dance. But also, what an incredible opportunity to have these performers from New York, Israel, here. And we get to be some of the first audiences to see their work in progress. So real quick, before we go, you also have a residency in July.
Yeah, we have two more residencies. In July, we have a really special one with another group from New York, and we're also collaborating with a local dancer here, a former Aspen Santa Fe ballet dancer. We're going to do that at the Contemporary, and it's going to be their first dance performance at the new venue. It will be outside. We're going to have some local kids open up for that show because we have a kids camp the week of that residency. So that group is called Converge Dance. And then at the end of August, leading into September, we have Kizuna Dance, and that's going to be a group of six that are also coming from New York, and they're super energetic, super physical, street dance mixed with Japanese styles. Ooh. He's going to do a little Japanese-style comedy mixed in, wow. And they'll be performing at the launch pad. So we have some really exciting stuff coming up.
We love it. It makes work so much more fun for us over there, so I have to thank you. All right, you guys, you chime in to danceinitiative.org to be hip to all these things that are going and get your ticket soon. Here is Nete.
My name is Nete Elshalmi. I am a choreographer and a performer. I grew up in Israel, but I have been based in New York City since 1999. And I also teach sometimes, often, in different academic institutions, sharing my work. Kind of teach through sharing my work. That's me. I work with different dancers, so each project has its own cast. It's not like I and maintaining a dance company. Mm-hmm. But I've had an ongoing presence as a choreographer in the city since, for the past like 20-some years.
And right now, in this very moment, you're in Central Park. Is that right?
I am.
Yes.
Yes.
We can hear the birds. It's really beautiful.
Well, I was just came from the studio. I was in rehearsal, and then my mother, who is here visiting from Israel, is in town, so I'm going to meet her for a few hours in the park before we have to go to, before I actually have another meeting. So, yeah, I'm in Central Park.
Wow. And you were recently in Israel.
I was, yes.
For how long total?
Well, this trip was basically all of the month of May and a little bit more, so it's about 5.5 weeks. But during the pandemic, my husband and I spent the whole fall semester in Israel, as well as the previous month of June and July. So we have spent a lot of time in Israel this year.
Yeah.
It's been unbelievable. Yeah. Wonderful.
Good. And this last time that you were there, there was a lot of unrest for the first part of your trip, right? And then it kind of shifted overnight, sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it was really disheartening. It was frustrating. It was sad, and it was scary to be there during the, I guess it was an 11-day war, and we're using that word, war. And it was the first time for me that I had been, like, in Tel Aviv with sirens and running to a shelter and seeing things explode in the air above.
Wow.
But I had grown up there with versions of that reality. Grew up in the north. It was a long time. It's been a long time since I heard a siren and had to go do something about it. So that was sort of, kind of intense. But at the same time, we felt relatively safe compared to people in Gaza, and we're very aware of that major, major difference in how the situation was affecting us. And, it was like after so many months of this pandemic business, it was like Israel was opening up. Everybody's, very, very high percentage of the population is vaccinated. And so they were really kind of on a roll to open up. And then this war broke out, and kind of a similar effect happened where there was, violence in the air in kind of abstract ways, like bombs. Hmm. They're not abstract, but you don't see it. It's not a person-to-person thing. But then there was also violence in the streets in neighborhoods that are usually really peaceful in between, Palestinians and Jews that usually get along really well. So there was this sense of, like, the outdoors or the transferring of your body from one location to another was, yet again, post-pandemic, was presenting itself as precarious. So once again, people were kind of walking themselves in. So that was really hard.
Mm.
But it was short-lived. And as you said, it kind of, like, the minute the ceasefire was announced, everybody was sort of back in the cafes, and I was back in the swimming in the ocean and going to dance studios. And so,
wow.
Yeah, the trip.
Do you find that translates along with the pandemic into your work right now? You just mentioned this kind of like transferring your body from one place to another. It sounds very physical, and I could see that being translated somehow into movement and dance. Are you experiencing any inspiration, I guess, from that?
I think just more like my continued sort of mission of elevating the body and its movements into sort of like broader discourse, just like bringing the body into any conversation possible. So the pandemic and this war enable those of us, who think about life that way, to think about how it's choreographing, how politics and things like a pandemic, like choreograph bodies, and have put forth and determine, dictate the movement. And I think that's interesting. I can't say that my work per se is going to have, is going to take any cues from this. It's more just like a broadening of understanding of what it means to be a body moving in relationship to other bodies, in relationship to to space. But I think that for me, actually, there's like a sense where dance is like a refuge from all of that. So instead of making work that's inspired by the pandemic, it's more just like, no, give me this space that's about aesthetics, that's about joy and desire and these other things that we can escape to because we need them, because then we can understand, we can ask again the questions of what is art for and what can art do for us. And it's not an essential thing, right? We learned this year that we're not essential workers, so what are we? So it's more just like the pandemic and then we're like give opportunities to think again and question and redefine and reaffirm what we do as dance makers.
Sure, yeah. I wanted to also ask about growing up in Israel and how, when and how did dance first present itself in your life?
First of all, Megan, your questions are so great. Thank you. I just wanted to thank you for your interesting and interested questions. Oh. I was actually born in the States, in South Carolina, of all places. And I started, I don't really remember this, but there are videos to document the fact that I started with some kind of tappy dancing when I was very young. And then at age 5, we relocated to Israel. And sorry, what was your question?
Oh,
you were asking about growing up there?
Well, right. I have forgotten that you were actually born in the U.S. So I was just asking when and how dance presented itself into your life. So it sounds like very, very early.
Very early. Yes, very, very early. So I moved there when I was 5 and I just like, you know, immediately kept dancing. And then I actually extracted myself from the Israeli army in order to not serve those 2.5 years. And that's when I moved to New York to attend NYU to School of the Arts so that I could keep dancing.
So
dance came into my life very, very early and it never left.
It never left. That was another question. You haven't ever taken a hiatus and tried something else or rejected it or? Wow.
I would say this past year was the first time I ever questioned my identity as a dance person and like my practice. Like, you know, in the height of the pandemic in New York, you're just like, well, if I'm not dancing, am I still a dancer?
Right.
And then, like, if I do want to be dancing, does dancing in my apartment give me anything? Does dancing over Zoom give me everything? And you just, like, you're just trying those questions out and realizing that, nope. Like I can take a break because dancing in my apartment over Zoom is not doing it for me. So I'm going to do other things. But, yeah, it was the first time in my life that I ever paused to think about. Not even pause to think. It's more just I was forced to ask myself if this is how this is meaningful for me. And was I still a dancer if I wasn't dancing or making dances? And I decided I was.
And the answer, yes. Yeah.
But that is not the answer that all the people in my life have come to. In other words, there is palpable attrition in our field every day. I'm hearing about more people who are moved out of New York or stopped dancing or this and that. So it was an existential crisis for many of us.
Do you think that that is born from the existential crisis, or do you think that that is because dancers learned that they weren't essential workers and they decided to go get, you know, a different job that's more consistent?
Well, I think an existential crisis can come from that sense of, like, you know, what is my meaning? You know, how is this in any way meaningful and sustainable? And how is this politically responsible, socially responsible, economically responsible? You know, it's not easy to answer the question of, like, why dance matters. You know,
it's not
much. And I think, so I think that. That is the existential crisis. Like, well, if I stop doing it and all the people that my community is kind of dissipated and the world around me doesn't seem to need me, then what the hell am I doing? So I think a lot of people have that kind of, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm not very practically oriented. Like, I would never sit down and think like, oh, what job should I have so that I could sustain my life? Like, I just never had that thought. But I think a lot of people, especially in America, like, think about, what's the right job to have?
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe you're right. Maybe some dancers decided that this was ludicrous to pursue this sort of like you know, unnecessary or like mysterious poetic art form. I don't know. But I do know that there's movement and change and destabilization in the field.
Yeah. I didn't tell you that I was going to ask you this, so I'm sorry if this is putting you on the spot. But
no worries.
Can you take a stab at why dance matters?
Well, it feels like it matters. It's always felt like it matters to me for a few different reasons. Inherent in dance is this sort of like, on the one hand, people are doing it, so there's always going to be stories and psychology and identity and emotion and all this, you know, and anatomy, and there's like really rich fundamental aspects of our existence. And then there's going to be this other thing that we're doing all these movements and we don't know what they are and why they are, and they make us react in certain ways, and the fact that we can't name them, we can't codify them in language, is just really valuable. Like, we just, so dance, I love that it doesn't succeed over Zoom. Like, it's not readily mediated by screens. I mean, you can look at it on screens, and people do over Instagram and whatever. But if you've been to a live performance, you know you have to be, you know, it's, you have to be there, and it's going to go away afterwards, and it won't be the same. And it's so much labor. It's like so much physical labor, and then it just evaporates. It's just something just like precarious and precious and potent and sweaty, and that's really, it matters a lot. It matters a lot. And everybody has a body, and everybody moves. And if we can, you know, get interested in the poetics of that is something I care about. I think the problem is that people in our culture can be very impatient with things that they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want to get it. Mm-hmm. And that's why I love dance. It's like, just sit back and look at people doing things, like, and don't try to get it. Don't try to narrate that in language to yourself. Don't try to, you know, hold on to it, own it. Just marinate in this mysterious, beautiful, magical thing.
Mm. That's gorgeous.
Yeah. Well, I'm a little bit of a dance geek.
All right. It looks like we are in for some very, very, very interesting conversation next week. So I do hope everybody comes out and checks out Nete. And I'm not going to say her last name either, though I think it's Yerushalmi. But thank you so much, Megan Jansen, for being here. I am going to turn this over to some illustrious characters here in the Roaring Fork Valley. Brian Colley has entered the studio, and he's got a whole host of amazing artists here with him. So, Brian Colley, take it away.
Well, hi, everybody, and thanks for joining us. I'm here via Zoom, I hope. I think it's turned up. With some of the artists who are part of a show, a ceramics show at CMC Aspen. It's called Shared Earth, Ceramics of the Western Slope. The opening was just yesterday. And I just want everyone to say hi and maybe go around the virtual room here and introduce yourself real quick. Maybe start with Kay, since you're the curator.
Great. Hi.
Hi.
My name is Kay Cizark, and I'm an associate professor and gallery director at the Colorado Mountain College Aspen campus, and the luckiest person to be able to install 58 of the most beautiful ceramic objects recently in our gallery. So
Yay.
I'm so happy that Brian and Amy asked us to be here.
Thanks, Kay. Who wants to go next? Maybe Emily?
Yeah, I'm Emily Lanise. I've lived in the Valley for 30 years, and about 15 years ago started taking ceramic classes for my own mental health to get away from small children. And it has been life-saving, and I'm the happiest person ever playing in clay. My kids always know if they can't find me, I'm probably playing in clay. And thanks to Kay for our beautiful show last night.
And Emily, you're based in Aspen, is that right?
I'm a live in Aspen. Yeah. 30 years.
Excellent.
Very lucky.
Let's go to Wayne. Hi, Wayne.
Yeah, hi. My name is Wayne Pete Fish. I live down here in Grand Junction, and I have a little clay business here. And Katie called me up a while ago and asked me if I wanted to be in the show and if I knew other people that would like to be in it too. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun to participate in this show. It's absolutely great. There's so many great pieces in there. It's really diverse, and yeah, it's been great.
I can't wait to check it out. And we have Sarah Ransford here as well. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Brian.
Thanks
for including me here this afternoon. And Kay for putting together such an amazing show. It's really great to see all of the talent that we have on the Western Slope. There's a lot of amazing clay artists. There's an incredible clay community. And I feel so fortunate to be a part of it. And I've been working in clay since I went to see you and took my first class from Betty Woodman. And been very involved over the years with the Anderson Ranch. I've known Kay for a very long time. And we got to do an artisan residency together a couple of years ago. And I got to know her even a lot better, which has been really fun. And Wayne and I know each other well because we fire all the time together, because I have a studio down outside of Grand Junction in a little town called Loma. And so where I do a lot of my work. And it's really great to be here. Thanks for including us.
I love how the clay community is so connected like that. There's actually a quote on the CMC Aspen website for this show that Kay had. And you said, in a time when the world seems divided, let us find a common ground, celebrate community and our shared passion for clay. That really came out there when you said that, Sarah, that connection you guys have. What is it about that clay community? Is it, you know, this show is called Shared Earth. There's over 50 artists from all around the state. But what is it about ceramics that unites you so tightly? I feel like it happens more than some other media out there. Like, what would you say, Emily?
When I think about clay, it's such a strange thing. Sometimes we joke that when you put it in the kiln, you don't know what it's going to look like when it comes out. But in our studio, especially at CMC in Aspen, we have very, very beginners to people that are experts, obviously. And everyone helps each other. Like, we all help each other grow. We all communicate with each other. If we see something, we're like, or we'll ask an opinion and throw something else into it. That it just brings us all together to help each other grow in our own art. I think that's what I wanted to say.
That's awesome.
That's all.
Kay, can... Oh, Sarah. Yeah.
And I'm going to say this too. The nature of doing clay is you really learn from each other. You share ideas. You share glaze recipes. You fire together. I mean, one of the first times I ever fired at the Anderson Ranch was with Sam Harvey, who's been my dear friend ever since. And that was a very long time ago. And it's one of those things where you really communicate closely with friends, and you have a lot of time while you're firing, especially if you're doing wood firings, to chat. And it's a real community, and you have to watch out for each other and help each other, like Emily was saying. And I have to say that CMC, what Kay has done there at CMC for that clay community, it's been going on for as long as I've lived here. It was at the old CMC campus up in Aspen before Kay was even around. My friend Trina ran it, and even before that, somebody else was running it. And it's really been a huge part of this community, of the Aspen community. And I think, you know, between the Carbondale Clay Center, the Anderson Ranch, in the Roaring Fork Valley, there's so many venues for clay to happen. And I think that's really a gift that we have, and I know it extends all the way to the other communities in the Western Slope as well. So
I agree.
Yeah, and Wayne, in Grand Junction, is there that kind of community as well? that you found?
Yeah, there really is. There's a lot of people working together. We have a guild here in town that we do some functions with, and yeah, it's a great thing to do because, I mean, there's so much, for me, there's been a lot of failure, and to work through those problems with my clay and the way I'm going, it's really nice to have that resource to talk to other people and work with them.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the art center too, right?
Oh, Wayne? Yeah, the art center.
And Terry Shepherd, who's featured in this show as well. And he has another great clay community happening down in Grand Junction as well.
That's yes. So great. Kay, can you talk a little bit about how this show came together and how you
sure.
chose the artists that are participating?
Sure. Well, the first thing I did was make a giant list of all the people that I knew to send a little call out to, a big call out to. And one of the first people that I reached out to was actually Wayne, because I know Kyung-Hwa Oh, who runs Mesa's program, but I also knew that Wayne and Terry knew a lot of people in Grand Junction area. And Wayne was a pivotal person because he was the collection site for a lot of the work that the Grand Junction artists submitted. And he generously opened his studio up to let people drop off the work. And then actually my sister-in-law picked it up and brought it here. And I'll return it to the Grand Junction area after the show closes September 3rd. But I reached out to quite a few people, but one of the things that I think that we really share is, you know, the passion for the process of ceramics. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, like glass and other mediums, we can't do it alone, or it's harder to do it alone. So firing is much easier on us when we share that responsibility. And one of the premises for curating the exhibit was just to be really inclusive and not have a juried situation, and let people pick what they wanted to represent them and their work. And all levels are included in this show. And anybody that lived on the western side of the divide could enter, and we didn't turn anyone away. So that part of it is super dear to me.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. I can't wait to see this show in person. Oh my goodness. There must be all kinds of backgrounds then, and all kinds of different methods of clay. Can you talk about maybe the three of you artists who are here? Can you talk about what you've put in this show?
I started recently. Kay brought in that new black clay, which I started working it into porcelain. So I have a black clay and a white clay that I've been throwing, and what's it called? Kay, what is it?
Narikomi.
Narikomi.
Yeah.
So I just love the way they mix together because they remind me of the mountains, and sometimes they remind me of nighttime and the and clouds and stars. And I did it a couple times, and then my professor got me to work on those tiny little cups. And I had to work so hard, and I make big bowls and I think they're easy. And I made these teeny tiny half pound cups, and they were so hard. Huh. And those are the pieces that I chose to put in. They're a high fire black clay and porcelain mixed together.
Cool.
And mostly it was Kay getting me to work harder on it. It was, it was everyone and Stuart getting me to work harder and really practice my art, and having those two really push me is what got me my pieces that I put in the show. So I was very excited about that.
Nice.
Good.
Sarah, why don't you tell us about what you've got in the show?
I have a wall piece that was actually inspired last year during COVID. And I was spending a lot of time in my studio last year because there wasn't a whole lot of other stuff to do, and really super detailed. And I've been working in paper clay for over 10, 11 years now. And it really changed my work a lot, or the way I approached clay completely changed when I started using the paper clay. And so I'm just really was thinking a lot that the name of this piece, I think, is Entangled in Green. But it was, I started this series last year in COVID, and it was really all about, you know, just sort of being caught up in these fine detail, you know, just like being caught up in this space and just having to repeat forms and repeat lines and repeat, and just sort of this real, for me, it ends up becoming this meditation when I'm working in the studio on a lot of the work that I do. Mm-hmm. And it's really too a lot about, it's influenced that's on some level by water and the eddies in our life and the currents in our life and how we just get so caught up in them and get eddied out. And then especially last year during COVID, I've just, so that's the piece that I've got in the show.
Awesome. And Wayne.
Yeah. Hey, well, my piece is, it's a small bowl. It's kind of almost like a tray. It has a couple of handles on the side, and you know, so it's really usable and functional. Mm-hmm. And it's got a really nice green glaze that has a real patina type look to it. That the glaze looks like it's really old. The clay body is a really rich iron clay body, and it makes it break to that color. And the edges are all kind of curled up and into the pot, so it kind of draws you into the pot. And yeah, it's a nice piece. It's a thing that I've really been working with here lately, is to loosen up my form and have more of a flow in the bowl. And yeah, kind of draw you in a little bit more.
Oh, that's awesome. I only have a minute to go till we have to turn it over, but I just want people to know that this show is up at CMC at the Aspen campus, and it goes through September 3rd. The gallery hours are varied, but you can call to plan a visit. It's 970-925-7740. Thank you so much for taking time today, you all. It's really great to see you on Zoom. Thanks.
Thank you, Brian. No, it is
thank
nice.
You, thank
Thanks,
you.
Brian, thank you so for much. Doing this.
All right.
And thank you, Kay, for putting the show together.
Oh, yeah. So
thank
great.
You, Kay.
Always
you,
a group Kay. Effort. I have a great team, Misha, Misha Gibson, and Natalie Squiante that help, and a slew of volunteers. So
it thank you. Great.
It really was, and the food was delicious. It was so nice to just get to party.
That would right. be our call. Yes.
Suburban woman with a worried mind. No one in front of me and nothing behind. Sitting on a strange man's lap, drinking champagne. He's got light skin and an assassin's eye. I'm looking up into a cell.